Tonight on the Carolina Weather Group, we are looking at a devastating thunderstorm that rocked the city of Rock Hill this past weekend. The latest analysis with our guest, WCNC Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich, who's also going to be talking to us about the upcoming cicada invasion. What is the truth and what can you expect to see here in the Carolinas? That and more this week on the Carolina Weather Group. I'm James Brierton. It is April the 24th, 2024, and we are streaming to you live this week on YouTube, Facebook, X, and other platforms. Comment along with us as we welcome in Carolina Weather Group's Frank Strait in Columbia and our guest, WCNC Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich, who, disclaimer, we both work at the same TV station during the day, and Brad is gracious, as always, to be a friend of the Carolina Weather Group podcast here sometimes in the evenings. And Brad, we have two very distinct topics to talk about this week that are polar opposites, but I initially wanted to bring you on here to episode 490 to talk about the cicada invasion. Air quotes for those of you listening to the audio podcast. But of course, we're also going to have to talk about the devastating thunderstorm that impacted Rock Hill, South Carolina this past weekend, the historic storm. We will bring that to you in the second part of our conversation this week. So if you're watching this later on, we'll probably split the show in half when we put it to YouTube because the topics are so very, very different. So let's start with cicadas, Brad, if we may. I know you wrote a very lengthy article for our WCNC mobile app and website, The Truth About the Cicada Invasion. Mm-hmm. People are probably used to hearing the cicadas, but it's starting. This year is a little extra special. And yeah. What is the truth about what is really happening here?
So first things first, you got to know there's two types of cicadas, right? There's the ones that we see every summer. They're green, right? And those come in the late to midsummer time frame. They're kind of referred to as the dog day cicadas because they come out during the hottest, most humid time of year. Those come every year. And that's that sound of summer. We hear those cicadas all the time. They're green, though. When you see them, when they molt, they'll have a similar shell. What's happening this year is a periodical cicada. These cicadas only come back every 13 years or every 17 years, depending on part of the country. And they don't just come back in the hundreds, they come back in the millions and sometimes hundreds of millions in very select areas. And when they emerge, they all make the sounds at the same time as their mating sounds. And it can be absolutely devastating. They look different though. They're black with red eyes. That's the reason you know they're the periodical ones. Basically what they did, they burrow themselves in the ground and they sit there. They do feed off of some of the tree roots around the trees they're at. And they come out, they molt, they shed their skin. You'll see those shells all over the place. The males will make a whole racket of noise, which you'll hear. That's the mate with the females. They'll mate over a 3 or 4 week period. We'll have this swarm, and then they'll go back in the ground, and we won't see them again for 11 years. This is called Brood 19. I get 13 years and 19 mixed up. It's XIX, so your Roman numeral people will love that.
The 19, it does get confusing.
Yeah, brood 19, which comes back every 13 years. I mean, that's why the numbers are confusing. The last time they were around was in 2011. So some of the misinformation, I would say, it's not, and a little bit of hype, is there's two broods emerging this year, which is rare to have a 17 and 13 year in the same year, but they're not in the same location. So there's not double or triple or... it's not a double whammy. These won't even be in the same location. So it's like saying, you know, there's a concert in Chicago and there's a concert in Charlotte. And you go, well, there's going to be twice the traffic this weekend. No, they're in completely separate cities. So they're not going to overlap. And there's a small section in Illinois where they'll be close, but they're not expected to overlap. And because they emerge based on temperature, they don't all come out at the same time, even in our location, like in South Carolina, where, you know, we're down in the Midlands area where Frank is. They're already starting to swarm a little bit in Newberry County. And so we can tell that it's much warmer down there. So they're coming out quicker and then they'll move north and they'll come out in just droves. So that's kind of the truth. That's what I want people to know. It's like, hey, we saw a lot of stories about Cicada Mageddon and yes. Trillions. And the trillions things cracks me up because it's not, there's maybe trillions possibly for the whole country, but not in the Carolinas and not in your county, it's probably going to be in the millions.
You mentioned Newberry. So WLTX, the Tegna CBS station in Columbia, did this story. It's funny, but it's not funny, right? So the headline is that people keep calling 911 over the sound of the cicadas because they are reporting a strange siren sound late at night, constant, annoying, and it's the cicadas.
Yeah. It's really interesting because if you are kind of just far enough away where you don't hear them full blast, but you kind of faintly hear them, it is a weird sound. I'll be honest with you. Like the area I know around here that I saw them in 2011 is in the Pineville Ballantyne area, which isn't too far from my house. And I didn't hear any at my house, James, but I went to Sam's Club in Pineville to get tires changed. And I pulled out of Sam's Club and I'm like, what is that noise? And as I drove by the woods, the greenway behind the mall, it was deafening. And that's kind of what happens. You like in one part of town, it'll be like that. And you'll drive a mile away and there won't be any. So it's really select spots. And that's why I highlighted the blue. This map here is great because it shows the counties, but where the bugs, I actually put the little bug icon. That's actually where they occurred in 2011. So even in counties where we know they're going to be, they're only in a small area. So Northeast Charlotte, South Charlotte, Fort Mill, the Piper Glen area seems to be a hot spot. I know a lot. I just got some pictures and videos tonight from Pineville, Ballantyne, and then down in Newberry. That's they kind of follow some of the rivers in stream. So the Catawba River is going to be pretty active.
You can see it real clearly on the, I think it's a PD right there, right? Yeah. Coming through Albemarle and High Rock.
Yeah.
Frank, so what's it like down south right now where the temperature is maybe a little bit warmer? How's Columbia?
Well, it's warm in Columbia, but I haven't heard any cicadas yet. That being said, where I live is right next to I-26, and that might be enough to scare the cicadas away. And I-26 makes enough noise on its own.
Which you're on the map.
Especially since I'm, you know, a half mile from Malfunction Junction where I live. So there's plenty of noise
anymore,
from that.
Frank. They don't want you calling it that anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't like me calling it that, but until they fix it, I'm going to keep calling it Malfunction Junction.
The other thing, you know, so James, we get a lot of questions about, you know, they're kind of ugly looking, but they're absolutely harmless. They're not going to harm your plants. They do feed off the trees, but they don't have a big enough impact to cause major damage. The only plant that might be problematic, and they're not going to be around young trees, because that young tree, you know, if it was here 11 years ago or 13 years ago, I should say, it's going to be much bigger now. So young trees can be susceptible to damage, but for the most part, they don't harm anything. And in fact, a lot of animals eat them, like chickens and birds. And yes, copperheads like them, but they're not attracted to them because they're cold-blooded. It's a food of opportunity for them. So don't freak out about snakes either. And some dogs, you'll be surprised. Some pets will try to go around and eat them. So if you're walking the dog, it won't hurt them. But you probably don't want them eating too many of them. And the other thing for people eat them as well. We did a story on that. The crazy thing is they're closely related to shrimp. So if you have a shellfish allergy, you're not supposed to eat them.
Noted. Okay. Out of everything you say here tonight, that is probably what will stick with me.
Like
the most.
People are like, I wasn't going to eat them anyways, Brad. Thanks for that.
Good to know. Good
shrimp is my dad's favorite food.
But some people do. I mean, because they are a pretty good, you know, source of protein. And I joked in our meeting the other day, I said, well, you know, if you put chocolate on and deep fried, I think anyone would try it, right?
Yeah. Donna watching on Facebook. Thanks, Brad and company, for being the voice of reason regarding the cicadas. I feel like that is your brand, the voice of reason on all things science. And Doris is backing up your claim about McAlpine Creek. The last time they were really noisy.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing that I appreciate it. Thanks for those comments. Yeah. The funny thing is it's a cool enough phenomenon by itself. There's really no reason to hype it. Right. I mean, it's one of those things. It's like, it's amazing. Yes. There's going to be millions of bugs emerging. That story's over. Right. We don't need to have it like any more hype than that. But I think the double thing threw people off because it's a rare event to have the 17 and 13 years come back in the same year. It's just, they're not happening in the same spot. So I think that was people's big fears. Like, holy cow, I remember them 13 years ago. If there's twice as many, that's going to be even twice as bad, right?
It reminds me a lot of coming to you for all things like space.
Yeah.
Like, oh, the planets are aligning, or we're getting an eclipse. What can we really expect versus these headlines, which some of the headlines are clickbait. Some of the headlines, to your point from earlier, may just apply to other parts of the country.
Yeah. And so it's like, you know, you just got to be careful what you click on. And it's all about tempering expectations, right? You just like, this is what to expect. Though I do think it is interesting because we have so many transplants here. And I had somebody who lived in an area where I expect them to come back, and they weren't here in 2011. So they have no idea what's coming their way. And development's the other thing I worry about, because the one thing that could lower the numbers is, you know, if you're digging up ground and plowing trees down for new houses, condos, whatever, then you might be taking out some of the cicadas that were there 13 years ago. So I'll be curious to see if the numbers are actually smaller or lower than we expect.
Yeah, we've seen that with a lot of wildlife, especially in the Charlotte area, as the tree canopy comes down in development. And I'm sure it's the same in Frank's area and other parts of the Carolinas, is that wildlife and nature in general is being displaced.
But I think it's funny, because like every day I'm getting updates on where they are. And someone posted a comment, it's great, Cicada Safari is an app, and there's actually a website where you can report where they're emerging. And they're it's kind of citizen science, right? We're trying to keep track of where they are so we can kind of gauge. And that's how we know they're kind of moving north. They're in South Carolina now. And I think in the next week, probably by this weekend or next week, which is about the right time, I expected like the beginning of May would be like the sweet spot. I think that's when we're going to see them really come out in the Charlotte area.
And give us again, what were the soil temperatures that they like?
So they need 64 degrees at about 8 inches. That's pretty deep. And so once it gets about 64, they'll start emerging. But once the temperature gets above that, it accelerates the whole process. It just starts activating all of them. So we had a week last week of temperatures in the mid to upper 80s, which really warmed the soil temperature up pretty quickly. And with temperatures this week pretty mild and getting hotter for the weekend and next week, I think that's going to do the trick. That's going to really drive them all out. So once you see soil temperatures close to 70, it's really, we're really going to see them come out in mass. And trust me, you'll know, they'll be everywhere. But the sound to me is the biggest thing, because it is deafening. When you have millions of those all buzzing like that at the same time, it's absolutely nuts.
Well, we just put in the comments, and there's a QR code on the screen for anybody that wants to read your truth about the cicadas on WCNC.com and the mobile app. They can scan that or click the link to see more context from you. It's very interesting to see that this is overlapping.
And let us know. Let me know if you have pictures or video, they're emerging in your area. We're really trying to keep track of where they are. That's great information to pass along. And give us a general location. I don't need your address. Just a general location, like a town.
Yeah. The nearest intersection would do just fine. So, Frank, you're going to be first ground truth here on this panel tonight. You let us know when they start debating.
Okay, will do.
Yeah.
And you can hear them over the motorcycles whizzing by at 100 miles an hour on 26.
When we come back, the cars impacting these in the cars. I mean, I talk about bug splatter on your vehicle. Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah.
Oh. I don't want to leave it there, because that image is kind of gross. But
car washes will be packed. That's, I say that.
Between that and the pollen.
Yes, absolutely. Which is actually trending down, which is a good news for pollen.
That is. I'll leave it there. That's good news. I do. As an allergy sufferer, that is good news.
Amen.
Brad Panovich will be back with us coming up in just 60 seconds. We're going to take a short break here this week in the Carolina Weather Group. We're going to talk about the serious storm that hit Rock Hill, South Carolina this past weekend. Stay with us.
Have you ever seen what an indoor environmental assessment looks like in a commercial building or business? During a full assessment, we collect data throughout the building and compare the measurements room to room. We can also collect samples that go to a lab, such as the small cassette shown here, which will be analyzed for types and amounts of mold in the air. We follow up with a physical inspection, looking for moisture sources and using moisture meters to determine if any of your building materials are wet.
Go-ESG.com or 336-373-1538.
Hey, if you like what you're hearing this week, you can find the Carolina Weather Group on Spotify, and you can get our extras. They're dropping every Saturday. We're relaunching our panelist playlist series, so you get to know your favorite hosts, their favorite music. It's only available when you listen to the Carolina Weather Group feed on Spotify. It's mixed right in there with all of the week's episodes, so you can get those on Saturday in addition to our Wednesday episodes. Let's bring back in Frank Strait in Columbia, South Carolina with us tonight, along with Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich from WCNC Charlotte. So both of you guys are quite aware, as I'm sure our audience is, of a severe thunderstorm that just rocked Rock Hill, South Carolina, much of York County this past Saturday. We've seen a lot of the pictures on WCNC. We've seen them elsewhere of the devastation that was brought about not by a tornado, but by a severe thunderstorm. Brad, let me start with you before we bring in Frank to talk about his hometown. You were down there on Monday, Brad, to look firsthand at the storm damage. What did you see?
You know, from a wind damage standpoint, I've seen damage like that before. I've seen tornado damage that was worse. What I have never seen before in the Carolinas was the hail damage that we saw down there. It was absolutely out of this world. I mean, it's images that I've seen briefly, like in Kansas or Nebraska or the High Plains or the Front Range of the Rockies, where big hail is a much bigger problem. To see the hail damage and then combine that with wind-driven hail was just something I have never seen. I honestly, and this is not hyperbole, it is the worst hail damage I have seen in the Carolinas in my 21 years here. And it's not even remotely close, to be honest with you. The only one that is probably number two on that list would be in northern York County, southern Mecklenburg County, almost not too far away. In 2011, April 9th, we had baseball-sized hail with supercells and northwest flow that went through Fort Mill, Tiga K, parts of Ballantyne, the panhandle of Lancaster County. And I remember that primarily from the baseball hail hitting car dealerships and just obliterating cars. In Rock Hill, the south side of Rock Hill, with this storm, it wasn't just cars, but homes had their siding shredded on the windward side, windows broken, awnings completely dented and obliterated. I mean, I was talking to the researchers down at IBHS, which does hail testing down in Chester, and some of the stuff I was seeing was more reminiscent of larger hail, even though the largest hailstone that we know that we verified was probably close to 3 inches, like 2.5, maybe 2.75. You would normally see bigger hail causes damage, but the wind-driven part of it created enough kinetic energy to cause damage that you would normally see with like great brute-size hail. So the terminal velocity of this hail was roughly 65 to 75 miles per hour. And if you put 90 mile per hour winds on top of that, you get an idea. This was like golf balls and tennis ball size hail being launched at homes at over 120 miles per hour. It's just something I had never seen. I mean, look at that. Yeah. That's not one or two dents. That is the whole side of the house obliterated.
It's crazy when you think about this damage. And, you know, this damage is destructive. This damage is saddening and catastrophic. And the damage tells a very interesting story, because so many people see this damage and we immediately picture in our mind tornadoes. Yeah. And so there was a lot of conversation this past couple of days, and there still is, about whether or not there was or was not a tornado. And I think the most important thing, and we can delve into the science, is the conclusion from the National Weather Service that there was no tornado does not take away the devastation that was caused. It's just a scientific explanation. And I think this house, amongst other houses themselves, is what they cited, right? Because when you were down there, Brad, it's only the one side that got pelted, right?
Yeah, so I think you make a good point, James. And here's the thing, this not being a tornado does not diminish the damage. I think that's the learning part of this whole process, right? Tornado isn't the worst thing that can happen. I know a lot of people think it is. Severe thunderstorms, hurricanes, tornadoes, they're all at the same level. There's not like a hierarchy where one is a whole lot worse. Wind is wind, damage is damage. I made the kind of metaphor that if your house burns down and the cause is either a lightning strike, electrical fire, arson, cooking, those causes don't change the fact that your house is burned down, right? It's a fire, okay? In this case, the wind damage and hail damage is destructive. It doesn't matter if it came from a tornado, straight line winds, hurricane, derecho, which is there's all these bevies of ways that can happen, and it doesn't matter. But the hail actually helped prove that it was straight line winds, because like you said, the wind damage was the wind blown hail was only on one side of the house. The hail acted like tracers. It basically showed you that the wind was blowing all in one direction and made it easier to tell that it was straight line wind damage. And the environment was not conducive to tornadoes. The radar signature wasn't even a hint of low level rotation. There was mid level rotation because it was a supercell, but everything pointed to the fact that it was not a tornado, and then seeing the stuff firsthand just further confirmed it. But let's face it, 90 mile per hour winds, that's EF1 tornado strength anyways. So does it matter it was a tornado? No, it doesn't. Not to anybody who had their house damaged.
90 mile per hour winds, if we're just going to draw comparisons, right, would be like a hurricane force, category one hurricane force winds. And that caused damage like this. Crystal saying that on Saturday, with no internet and power, they were all convinced it was a tornado. Understandably. And again, regardless, very scary situation. We'll get to the radar analysis in just a moment. But Frank, let me ask you, because Brad said something there that I think you would also said in our pre-show. Frank, you're from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Have you ever seen anything like this in the Carolinas?
No, never seen anything like this. Definitely not in Rock Hill. Going back and looking at some of the hail reports of the past in South Carolina, I don't know if the volume of hail was the same in these past events or not, but we've had a few events where we've had super large hail reported. The largest reported in York County anyway, of course, verifying these are a different story, but the largest reported in York County was 4 inches with this storm, softball sized. And that's, you know, that's elite level hail for South Carolina. Sure. It's only happened a handful of times in the past. The largest hailstone on record for South Carolina is 4.5 inches, so slightly bigger than softball size. That's happened 3 times before, mostly in Florence County and Horry County and Georgetown County have seen hail that big as well. But a total of, it looks like about 12 or 13 total events with softball or larger sized hail in South Carolina. So this is up there amongst the worst that the state has ever seen in terms of hail.
Yeah. Brad, we have your radar analysis here talking about the hail. What are we seeing here?
Yeah, so this is the volumetric scan, which is one of the great features of radar, because radar takes slices and you can piece them all together and make a 3D model. And the thing, for meteorologically, a lot of people looking at that looks really cool. But from a meteorological standpoint, the red line you see in the background in the grid, that's minus 20 degrees Celsius. Okay, so you go up to the top of that storm at 40,000 feet, it's probably close to 40, 50 below zero, right? And we're getting water taken up to that height, and you're just creating monster hail. And so that hail core shows up clearly on the radar, and you see it descend right on top of Rock Hill. So some of the radar signatures were some of the strongest I'd ever seen for hail. The reflectivity, we call it DBZs. It's basically how strong the reflectivity is, was coming back at these high reflectivities of 80, 85, 90 DBZs. Which means it's not bouncing off a raindrop, it's bouncing off a solid object. And in this case, it was large, giant hail. The only thing that bounces back that strong are solid objects. And honestly, we only see that with big hail or debris from a tornado in the storm. So to see that at that height, and that's what makes it scary, because think about it, you got a baseball size piece of hail up at 30,000 feet. Now imagine that falling from that height, falling from the height of an airplane. You get an idea of that terminal velocity and how damaging that can be. And the other crazy thing we saw down there, and I wish I had the picture, but there was a swath of tree damage from the hail that there wasn't a single leaf on the trees. It looked like winter trees. And on either side, you had green. So you could see how narrow the path of the hail was. But the wind damage was actually wider. And that's what the Weather Service actually found as well. The width of the macro burst, which is called the downburst, the width, was probably 2.5-3 miles in width. But the hail path, if you will, was probably only like a mile or less. So it was a much narrower path. So it was kind of interesting to see the wind damage outside of areas that didn't see any hail. And driving through Rock Hill, you go from one street where there's nothing, and then 3 or 4 streets over, you see just leaves and debris everywhere. It was really crazy. Like I said, seeing it firsthand, some of the pictures look crazy. I'm telling you, it looked even worse in person.
I can't imagine. And then you also get the sensation of like the smell. I imagine you were smelling maybe a lot of sap in the trees.
There was 1 yard that was like, I thought there were leaves in the yard, but I went up and it was fresh grass, but there was dents, like craters all over the lawn.
From the actual impact.
Yeah, from the impact of the hail. So the yard looked really weird. It looked like the surface of a golf ball because there were so many dimples or like craters in the lawn. And the crazy thing was, so we went there Monday, right? They're doing the survey. This is maybe 40 hours after. There were still piles of hail on the ground on Monday in parts of Rock Hill. It was
like crazy. It accumulated like it was snow.
Yeah, because it rolled off houses. And so there were like drifts, almost like piles of it. And there were still those piles around all weekend long when temperatures were in the 70s.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty intense and crazy. And you were down there on Monday covering the storm for WCNC Charlotte. And you asked a question of Steve Wilkinson, who is the meteorologist in charge of the local National Weather Service office in Greenville, Spartanburg. We heard it in the WCNC coverage. I'm going to play it here in a second. And then I kind of want to get into a little bit of the social science and the kind of criteria protocol that you're talking about here. Let's take a listen.
Want to get a lower and severe, but there's hard to differentiate between the two. So, yes.
Was there any thought of going with the destructive tags of the WEAs would have been activated?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know we went with a considerable tag, mm-hmm. and winds at about 70 miles an hour and 2.5-inch hail was the highest that we went. So I think it was under consideration. It's there's one of the things that is very difficult. So let me back up and give a little explanation. He knows more about this. Maybe some of you don't know. Within a severe thunderstorm warning, we try to put what we call tags in there. And so a kind of base severe thunderstorm warning might have 60 mile an hour winds and 1-inch diameter hail. It's kind of a low end type severe thunderstorm warning. And that's what most type storms are, something like that. In this case, it started with that maybe back to the west. And then as it continued to grow and become stronger, the tags in it were bumped up to at a peak, 2.5-inch diameter hail and 70 mile an hour winds. Now, I'll be the first to admit that didn't quite highlight exactly how strong this was. As a meteorologist in the office, you don't really know exactly what's going on underneath it. You know it's hailing very large. You know the winds are blowing exactly what you're getting. But we try to forecast that. So
Brad, I think it's a little bit of a two-way street, right? When we think about the social science here, because he's saying in the forecast office, it's a little bit of them not knowing what's going on. And then I also think about this comment on Facebook from Crystal about the power being out and them not knowing exactly what's going on. So what is WEA and how would that maybe have helped?
So something weird about this event as well. I mean, in and of itself, it's a powerful storm. I do want to tell everybody that the warning process, at least from the issuing of the warnings from the Weather Service, actually worked pretty well. The average lead time for the severe thunderstorm warnings with this event was 29 minutes, so almost 30 minutes. But one of the things I saw, and it's probably attributed to power outages, cell phone towers coming down, a lot of people weren't getting the alerts for these warnings via their phone app or TV or radio because the power was out. And the third-party apps, I'm talking about, I'm not going to name companies, but you know, if it's a company that you can download the app from, those weren't working. So a WEA is called a wireless emergency alert. And for those that don't know, wireless emergency alerts are built into your phone. You don't pay for them. They don't cost you any money. They are a partnership with the government and your cell phone carrier. So, but they're only set off in the worst of worst situations. Tornado warnings, flash flood warnings, and then in rare cases, there's a high-level severe thunderstorm warning called a destructive severe thunderstorm warning, 80 mile per hour winds and baseball size hail. Think of derecho. Think of this event, right? Here you go. If it's a destructive tag, then your phone will go off. The WEA will be activated for that severe thunderstorm warning. Now, in the Weather Service office, the considerable was pretty potent. I mean, 70 mile per hour winds and golf ball size hail is a big deal. They didn't know that the alerts weren't reaching people because they're not privy to what's going on with third-party apps. So in hindsight, yeah, it would have been great to activate the WEA to kind of blast through all the non-working apps and get it out there. But at the time, they didn't know. And then also, the worst weather didn't happen until it really got on top of Rock Hill. So that was a problem. But it's a frustrating thing. And this is like the dilemma we run into as meteorologists. You know, honestly, the day before, we didn't think there was going to be severe weather on Saturday. I'm going to be totally transparent. It looked like if we're going to see severe weather, it was going to be on Friday. Saturday woke up and the cold front hadn't moved south very far. It was pretty muggy on Saturday morning. That's the first thing I noticed. I'm like, wow, this front isn't making much progress. So it took a while to get to the South Carolina border. And that didn't happen until 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. By that time, it was in the low 80s. So we actually ended up getting the severe storms we thought we were going to get on Friday. We got them on Saturday. Now, in hindsight, it would have been great to know that on Friday, but we kind of knew this was going to happen in the middle of the day Saturday. And I know Frank mentioned this. We were actually put back into a marginal risk when we were not in one. So there was that we knew about this, that there was going to be a risk. And then the warnings themselves didn't come up until the storms developed, which were really good warnings. But at the end of the day, if people don't get the warnings, it doesn't really matter, right? And we always say that the forecast is not a good forecast. It doesn't matter if you verified, if people can't get the information, act upon it, then maybe it isn't a good forecast. And so I think that that's something we have to learn from this event. The two biggest takeaways I would tell people watching: one, you need to take severe thunderstorm warnings as seriously as tornadoes sometimes. You really do. And two, you need multiple ways to get warnings. Our rule of thumb is you need three ways, because you need redundancy. If one fails, you have a backup. If the backup fails, you got a backup to the backup. So I think if there's one thing to learn, have three ways to get warnings and take severe thunderstorm warnings seriously, especially in these situations.
Yeah, there was, I think, so many factors at play here. And I think you're right a little bit, and I appreciate the transparency about the forecast, right? Because I went back after knowing that the storm happened, and after knowing that we worked together, right? I was like, what did Brett say on Friday? What did we say on Saturday morning? What did everyone else say on Saturday morning? And yeah, there was still a threat of like summer, like afternoon pop-up showers and thunderstorms. Yeah. Yes, we were in that marginal risk tier 1 out of 5 from the Storm Prediction Center. But also, it really did kind of just feel like it's going to be one of those stray pop-up showers or thunderstorms when you looked at the future cast, or even the fact that there was a mesoscale discussion just hours earlier that said 20% chance of a watch, which I always joke, for those who don't know, a mesoscale discussion is like the watch of a watch before a warning. Yeah. It's like we're way back in, like, so it really was a bit of a, when you sometimes say, Brad, there's a non-zero percent chance of something happening, but it's really low. Yeah. This is that.
Well, and let's be honest, like, this is a horrible storm, one of the worst we've seen, but it was pretty much it. There was maybe one other storm near Lumberton. So it was one of those days where, yeah, we had two cells develop and they just happened to be the worst type of cells. So yeah, and that makes it a rare event by itself as well, because, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, we're going to have a chance of severe storms and you expect several warnings and a watch. It certainly didn't feel like that on Saturday. It's just this one storm. Yeah. And from a radar analysis standpoint, I know Frank's going to talk about this. There's a lot of small scale stuff going on. This storm started in Cleveland County. It split. It turned right. It did a lot of things that you look for and go, holy cow, this is going to be a bad storm. And this radar loop's great because the bright reds there, that's when the worst hail happened, literally on the southwest side of Rock Hill. It just, everything threw down. There was hail in York, but it was nowhere near the size or intensity as it was and got to Rock Hill. And let's be honest, if that storm moves 10 miles further south, it impacts homes, but not nearly the population density that it affects. So that's the other thing. It's just, this hit a city. If it hits rural areas, you're talking about loss of agricultural interest and probably some farms and some other small homes, but there's just less people in the way. This was right in the heart of a pretty significant city. And so then a lot of people are impacted.
Frank, I know you've been looking at that radar analysis. What sticks with you?
Well, the thing that sticks with me most, going back and looking at the radar of this, and I didn't look at the higher level radar tilts and the volumetric stuff that Brad has, at least not as carefully. But I've only looked mostly at the lowest tilts. And the thing that sticks out, and I call it up on my phone while Brad was talking. Hopefully you can see it.
You're all sorts of chroma keying.
Yeah, all sorts of keying out, unfortunately. Get it closer to my camera, get it further away. I don't know what's going to help. But hopefully, briefly, it showed up. That on this lowest tilt scan here, when the storm was almost right over Rock Hill, there was one spot there where the reflectivity was 76 dBZ. That is the highest I've ever seen in the Carolinas on the lowest tilt. Now, a lot of people, most of you don't understand what 76 dBZ means. Well, you can
sometimes see, I need hail, a refresher.
Yeah, you can see hail with as little as 35 to 40. Even severe hail. But when you have the reflectivity that high, it's you have one or two things going on, and sometimes both. And that was both in this case. You either have a large volume of hail, just lots and lots of hail coming down, or you have really, really big hail. In this case, it was both. So that's what sticks out to me, is just how high those reflectivity values were. As for the talk about tornadoes, you know, the conditions weren't favorable for a tornado to happen. Yes, it was a supercell thunderstorm, but I think it's less than half of supercell thunderstorms actually make tornadoes. In this case, conditions weren't favorable for a tornado. You can get supercells to occur when you have wind shear well above the surface, but then you don't get a tornado unless you also have that wind shear near the surface. That was the case here. All the wind shear was well aloft, and so you had a rotating updraft there, but you didn't have conditions favorable for that updraft to reach the surface and spawn a tornado. Also working against you was the high cloud bases. What we call the lifted condensation level, LCL, which is where your cloud bases occur when there's thunderstorms going on, it was over 5,000 feet, and that's not favorable for tornadoes at all. You're more likely to see that when you have the lower cloud basis below like 2,000 feet. So I don't think there was a true tornado, but on the other hand, all kinds of weird little eddies develop in these thunderstorms, especially on the leading edge of outflow boundaries. The bigger one, these bigger eddies sometimes look like a tornado, and we call those gustnadoes because they look and act so much like tornadoes. That might have happened here, but probably not. It probably was just a local swirling motion that just happens in a thunderstorm, and people says, oh heck, that's a tornado. When it wasn't really a tornado, but it kind of looks like one.
Yeah. So the other thing, Frank, that's interesting from just a structural standpoint, and one of the things that I knew right away that, probably wasn't a tornado, was the videos. You see the hail and the wind are occurring at the same time. And yes, sometimes you can get hail to wrap into the tornadic circulation. But as anybody who chases knows, the rain and hail core is usually offset from where the tornado is, right? The hail and the rain is usually ahead of the tornado. The tornado is usually on the backside of that. So for them to simultaneously occur is like, that's not the spot of the storm where you would have a tornado. You don't normally have the tornado and hail in the same location.
Exactly. And when you have this large volume of really big giant hail coming down, when you have that happening over Rock Hill, you would expect, or if that were to happen over downtown Rock Hill, you'd expect the tornado to happen somewhere over towards South Point High School.
Yeah.
You would not expect those two to be co-located. They're going to be kind of tapping in two separate parts of the storm. So that's why another reason I don't think there was a tornado at all here. But that, again, that doesn't diminish what happened. And this has happened in the past in other parts of the country. I remember back in 2019, I was at a conference where they described a similar situation to what happened in Rock Hill that happened in Omaha, Nebraska, years ago. It was 2018 or 2019. I forget exactly, where they had a large volume of very large hail, 2 to 3 inch hail. And it was driven by the same caliber of winds that Rock Hill saw, and the damage was much the same. Wind-driven hail will do some pretty extreme damage, and that's what we saw here. Now going back to the forecast part of this, again, this was a situation, again, a marginal risk was out, and we just weren't really expecting a storm like this to happen. I mean, sure, there was some instability. The Cape was 1200 or something like that. It's enough for severe weather, but you don't expect something like this from 1200 Cape.
A day like this, you probably see some pea-sized hail and a 15 right. base level thunderstorm, right?
Right.
To see the monster hail and the wind that this produced was just, it just goes to show you when the atmosphere can do crazy things. And that's why even on a day where you're not expecting a lot of storms, just staying weather aware. I think we had a great comment about that. And it's really important because the fact that you've got a 30-minute heads up should have been enough to give people like, hey, we didn't know this is going to happen this morning, but here's a 29-minute warning that we've got big hail heading your way. My biggest concern, it's like the nightmare I have as a meteorologist, is that something bad's going to happen and you can't get people the information. And that's kind of what happened in Rock Hill. For some reason, we still got to look into why that happened, but I heard it from a bevy of people, like they had no warning and they have all these different apps on their phone and they weren't getting it. So I don't know if it was a cell service issue, a power issue, the apps, I don't know, but something clearly happened because a lot of people did not get any warning at all.
There was a glitch in the system somewhere. And, we talk about how the WEA would have helped. Yes, it would have. But in order to do that, the Weather Service has to actually forecast something to happen that that they didn't think was going to happen.
Yep.
And they have however, to
know. However, it actually happened, however. So yeah. you kind of walking the fine line there. They were calling for 2-inch plus hail, and that doesn't justify the destructive tag.
They probably thought they were, and I talked to Steve briefly about this. They probably thought in the office, like, wow, we're going way overboard. 70, and that's probably right. The high end, and ended up it wasn't high enough.
Right. And again, it's one of those things the situation just is not the kind of situation where you expect one of these high end wind and hail events like we saw in Rock Hill. You certainly thought, well, yeah, there can be some. Maybe quarter-sized hail and maybe 60, maybe 70 mile an hour winds. It didn't look like the situation where you're going to have what happened. Yeah. And if the weather service would have thought, well, they're going to get softball-sized hail and 90 mile an hour winds, yeah, they would have put a destructive tag on it. The WAEA would have gone off, and everybody would have got these warnings on their cell phones through that system.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, another thing I'm thinking about, not faulting
the weather service at all, because no. If I were their shoes, I would have done the same thing they did.
Hindsight being 2020, there's multiple things here. I think we all kind of wish everyone had done a little bit differently. What were you going to say, Brad?
So, James, you brought up a good point about the social science part. And one of the things that plays into this, the warning process here that we don't often think about, it's a weekend, right? It's a Saturday. People are doing all these other activities. They're not tuned in to the weather and news as much as you might. They're probably not even looking at their phone as much, because the Come See Me Festival was going on the same day as well, which thank goodness this storm passed just north of there. There was some small hail there, but you had an outdoor venue with a stage and temporary structures. If that, the heart of that cell went through there, we would have had something like out of Red Rocks where the baseball size hail is pummeling people outside. There would have been massive injuries and maybe even fatalities if that happened. So
yeah, I agree with you, man.
We got lucky there, because that's the fear on a weekend where it's like people aren't paying attention to as much, and it's harder to get the warnings out because you don't have people's attention. It's a beautiful day. Everyone's outside doing whatever. And so it's even harder to get people's attention for these things.
I like this comment from Paige. I got two alerts at least 20 minutes before it arrived just outside Newport. So I think that's a use case of the system was there. It maybe just didn't reach everyone we would have hoped it would have reached, which is where your graphic about having multiple ways to receive warnings. And
that, I love that comment, by the way, because that's the way to do it. Because one of the warnings that we have, and people think it's silly, you know, call friends or text friends or family. It's actually not, because, you know, people, I hope people listen to me, but they're going to ignore me because they don't know me really, right? It's just Brad, you know, or it's the weather service or it's whatever the government sent out a warning. But if your family member calls you and goes, hey, there's a bad storm heading your way, you're more likely going to take shelter or do something. So, and you might be paying attention and they are not. So I think that's always great, because that can help amplify the message. And that's what's so great about mass communication. If only like 25 or 30 people are listening to me at one point, and they contact 25 or 30 other people, and then they contact, you can multiply the message and get it to as many people as possible. So that is a, thank you for doing that, because that is a great, great tip, Susie. That's one of our tips for getting warnings out.
Well, until you have the opportunity to call everyone personally, Brad, Amy's comment of, I heard the thunder and I checked the WCNC app for weather lots and saw the warning, which as the executive producer of Digital Weather makes me feel good that was there and working. So thank you, Amy. Yeah. And then the lights started flashing. Frank, what were you going to say?
Just to reinforce Brad's point there, to give your friends and family a call, what was actually happening back on Saturday in my life, I was taking a nap when the storm was going through Rock Hill. And I hate that, because I could have called my cousin, who actually had some fairly significant damage from this storm, and said, hey, you got a really bad storm coming your way with some serious wind and hail. But I mean, suppose, you know, you knew somebody, you're in the same situation. Suppose you know somebody that's in the path of the storm. Maybe they're taking a nap that day and aren't getting the warnings because they're asleep in the middle of the day.
Very true.
But yeah, I was near death Saturday afternoon, because I was at a conference Thursday and Friday. I didn't sleep well Thursday night and Friday night. So I was glad to be home in my own bed and being able to take a nap. But it meant that I missed an opportunity to warn some friends and family up in Rock Hill that some real high end event was coming their way.
Brad, I know you got to get ready for the 11 o'clock news and WCNC Charlotte coming up here very soon. I think you have a screen share up you wanted to show before you go. What are we looking at?
Yeah, so this is, to me, one of the most telling cell or pictures of the whole storm. So a couple things first jump off at you. This is a drone footage taken of a house, and you can see the siding completely shattered. And then look off to the top. You see all the trees, how there's no leaves on them, and it looks like they've even been debarked. That's from the impact of the hail. And if you look in the grass by those trees, that is not, that white stuff is actually still the piles of hail. And so this was taken a day later. Wow. So just tells you how devastating. And what you probably can't tell me unless you look really closely is the awning on the front of the house there. That's a metal awning, and it's all dent up, and there's holes in it as well. And this roof, even though it looks good, those asphalt shingles got holes in them. And I will tell you just a story from some of the roofers that I know. And by the way, anyone in this area, make sure you get a local reputable roofer, somebody, and talk to your insurance agents. There's a lot of scammers out there in events like this. So please make sure you're really double checking your references here. But they were telling me they had seen hail damage they'd never seen before, where the hail actually went through the shingle, the paper, you know, sometimes the underlayment, and went through the sheeting or the decking, the wood. And so actually caused holes through the OSB or the plywood that's on the roof. And that's just incredible, because that's that the amount of force that takes is something that you would see with 3.5 inch diameter hail, according to the guys at IBHS. So it's just incredible to see that kind of damage.
Absolutely incredible. And while from an atmospheric science standpoint, it is fascinating to look at, I would be okay if we didn't ever see it again.
Oh, no way. I'm telling you, when I chase, I tell people all the time, and I'll tell this to anybody, when you chase tornadoes, the worst part of chasing is getting stuck in a hail core. It is just the most, and if it's your car, rent a car if you can, but if it's your car and get the insurance. But if it's your car, that is the most helpless feeling, because all that sound, it's like dollar signs, you know, that's just money coming out of your pocket because your car is getting obliterated. It's just the worst feeling.
If anybody needs assistance in York County, there is a crisis cleanup hotline. It is 803-250-3679. 803-250-3679. We know Habitat for Humanity. We know Samaritan's Purse. We know the folks from Billy Graham are out there helping the communities, along with so many other organizations. They are also looking for volunteers to help feed, to help construct, to help clean up, if you're interested in helping the people of York County in this ongoing cleanup. Brad Panovich, Chief Meteorologist, WCNC Charlotte, we appreciate your insight as always, and we'll see you coming up on the 11 o'clock news.
Yep. Thanks for having me, guys. And thanks for doing that at the end there, James, because being down there, there's a lot of people that need a lot of help, and it's going to be a long recovery. And so just clearing trees and helping them, because some of these people still don't have power. So the fact that they not only have their house damaged, but they haven't had a refrigerator to keep food cold. So the food has been a big part of this as well, to make sure people have a meal. So please, if you can assist any way, please go down there and help out. And some great comments in here about double checking with the contractors, because on Monday, the signs were everywhere, like political signs for contractors, roofers. They're all, and you see out of state license plates, you know, and I'm not talking North Carolina, so I'm talking like out of our area plates that, you know, they drove in just for this to get money. So just be really, really careful. There are great reputable roofers in this area. They're reputable, and also they're local. They're going to be more willing to help out. This is their community as well. So please lean on those people as much as you can.
If they're local, you know where to find them later on if they're
afterwards. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Frank Strait, Columbia, South Carolina. Good to see you as always. And sorry to see this happen to anyone's hometown and yours in particular here, Frank.
Yeah, it's a tough one to see what happened there. And not only did it happen, and not only did it, a ton of people experience some serious damage, but some of the worst of this actually happened in one of the lower income parts of Rock Hill. And there was a lot of people who may not have insurance are really suffering from this. So I hope that anyone who can, I strongly encourage you to use one of those methods James brought up to assist, because there's a lot of people there that are going to need it.
Yeah, I know WCNC Charlotte will keep an eye on the cleanup efforts ongoing, and we'll be back here on the Carolina Weather Group next week with another podcast of our weekly show, talking weather, science, technology, and more for the Carolinas and beyond. Until then, I'm James Brierton. We will see you back here again real soon.